Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Your regular financial contributions make it possible for Beth Emmanuel to make D. Thomas Lancaster's weekly sermons available online. We genuinely appreciate your support and hope that you are blessed by these teachings. Feel free to download these audio files and share them with your friends and family. Please consider joining Beth Emmanuel's extended virtual family and support our efforts for the kingdom with a gift by clicking on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
The world hates the disciples of Yeshua for the same reason it hates the Jewish people. It's the same reason that the Egyptians hated the children of Israel living in their midst. It's because we don't belong to the world. The world has hated them because we are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. John 17:14. We're different. We're not from around here. If you were of the world, the world would love its own, but because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, because of this, the world hates you. John 15:9. The Egyptians hated the strangers in their midst. It's human nature to fear and hate strangers, foreigners, and people who are different from us, but it's also a sin to do so. It's part of the sin of baseless hatred. The Torah says, "You shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourselves know the feelings of a stranger, for you also were strangers in the land of Egypt." Exodus 23:9. The Egyptians feared and hated the children of Israel in their midst, primarily because they weren't Egyptians. The Hebrews in Egypt spoke a strange language that the Egyptians did not know, Psalm 81:6. They kept to themselves. They were herdsmen and shepherds, and every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians, Genesis 46:34. They dressed differently. Their modest, Bedouin-style manner of garb looked comically backward among the sexy, body-revealing fashions of high Egyptian culture. For that matter, the Hebrews had a completely different set of sexual values that seemed incomprehensible to the likes of Potiphar's wife and the rest of Egyptian society. Leviticus 18:3. Worse yet, the Hebrews had their own religion and their own God. They didn't worship idols or any of the Egyptian deities. The sacrifices they offered to their God were an abomination to the Egyptians before their eyes. Exodus 8:26. Added all together, the Egyptians found their strange ways intolerable and their strange religion insufferable. They refused to even eat with the foreigners in their midst. The Egyptians could not eat bread with the Hebrews, for that is loathsome to the Egyptians. Genesis 43:32. In the days of Joseph and his brothers, things were more tolerable for the children of Israel living in Goshen. The Hebrews almost felt welcome. They began to imagine that Egypt could be their new home and that they could be part of Egypt. They prospered and multiplied. They began to adopt Egyptian customs, manners, and cultural elements, including the idols of Egypt. Ezekiel 20:7 and 8. For a little while, it seemed as though the Hebrews would become part of Egypt and forget about the God of their forefathers and the land he had promised to them. Those days ended when a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Exodus 1:8. Among the 70 nations. All the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number, but Joseph was already in Egypt. Exodus 1:5. The irrational hatred for the Jewish people that burns throughout the world goes beyond mere xenophobia. It's a fire fueled and stoked by spiritual forces at war with the God of Israel. The false gods of the nations, Satan and his minions, try to discredit the Lord by subjugating his people and destroying them. It's a spiritual war. Genesis 46:27 says that the children of Israel who descended with Jacob into Egypt numbered 70 in all. The Torah repeats that information in Exodus 1:5. The number 70 is significant in Judaism because it corresponds to the number of the descendants of Noah recorded in Genesis 10, the forefathers of the nations. The 70 names of Noah's children are the biblical Hebrew names of the 70 nations of humanity. For example, Noah's son Ham had a son named Mitzrayim, the Hebrew word for Egypt. The descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are not included in that list of names. Therefore, the Jewish people are not numbered among the 70. As the prophet Balaam observed, they are a people who dwells apart and will not be reckoned among the nations. Numbers 23:9. Moses explained that God divided the nations and assigned their boundaries according to the number of the sons of Israel, who went into Egypt with Jacob, 70 in all. When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of man, he set boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the sons of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the allotment of his inheritance. Deuteronomy 32:8-9. Early Jewish sources interpret this to mean that God allotted authority over the descendants of the 70 nations to 70 angelic princes, such as the prince of Persia and the prince of Greece mentioned in Daniel 10:20. The apostles referred to them as the rulers, the powers, the world forces of this darkness, the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Ephesians 6:12. God gave the 70 nations over to those lower beings, but he retained the exclusive rights to Israel. He appointed the archangel Michael as his direct agent over Israel. Daniel 10:21-12:1. And the name Michael means, who is like God? Who is like you among the gods, O Lord? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in praises, working wonders? Exodus 15:11. The sons of Israel belong to God. The rest of the nations of the world belong to the rulers, powers, and world forces of this darkness administered by the devil. Matthew 4:8-9. When men and women from the nations defect from those spiritual affiliations, renounce their gods and the authority of the devil, surrender to the Jewish king, and devote themselves to the God of Israel, they become caught up in the same spiritual war, targets of the same spiritual hatred. This current world. Jewish teachings use the land of Egypt metaphorically to symbolize this current world of concealment, restriction, and limitation. Look on a map, and you will see that Egypt is a narrow strip of land that follows the flow of the Nile River as it passes between uninhabitable arid wilderness on either side. Maybe that's why the Hebrew word for Egypt, Mitzrayim, looks like and sounds like the Hebrew word for narrow places, Metzarim, a word that biblical Hebrew uses idiomatically to mean troubles. When contrasted against the broad expanse of the perfect world to come, this current world is a narrow place with many troubles. At his last Passover Seder, Yeshua warned his disciples that in this world, they would experience many troubles. But take courage. I have overcome the world. John 16:33. Life in this narrow world is like the expression, between a rock and a hard place. A person caught in a narrow place is vulnerable to ambush. He has limited options and can't see what's around him. The Psalms teach us to pray for deliverance. From the narrow place, I called upon the Lord. The Lord answered me and set me in a broad expanse. Psalm 118:5. Egypt also symbolizes the exile and dispersion of the Jewish people among the nations. The exodus from Egypt sets the pattern for the final redemption. Read the following verse out of Lamentations about the exile of the Jewish people. Keep in mind that the Hebrew word translated as narrow places looks and sounds like the Hebrew word for Egypt. Judah, exiled under affliction and under harsh servitude, dwells among the nations. She has found no rest. All her pursuers have overtaken her between the narrow places. Lamentations 1:3. While in exile, the Jewish people suffer under affliction and under harsh servitude among the nations. The Torah uses those same words to describe how the Egyptians treated the Hebrews. They afflicted them and made their lives bitter with harsh servitude. For the last 2,000 years, the Jewish people have been driven from nation to nation, sometimes fleeing persecution and sometimes forcibly expelled. The Misanthropists. Now a new king arose over Egypt, who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we." Exodus 1:8 and 9. In the days of the apostles, the emperor of Rome was the new king over the Jewish people, and the Romans did not like the Jews any more than the Egyptians did. The first century Roman historian Tacitus explains why the Romans did not like Jews. The History 5:5. He said, "All their customs, which are at once perverse and disgusting, owe their strength to their very badness." Roman writers frequently complained about the laziness of Jews who refused to work a whole day out of seven. Tacitus also thought it bizarre that the Jews did not burn their dead, but insisted on funeral rites, purification rituals, and a proper burial. He attributed those perverse and disgusting customs to their inflexible belief in the existence of an undying spirit within humans. As always, the Romans accused the Jews of avarice and greed. Tacitus complained about the wealth of the Jews, which he attributed to the fact that among themselves they are inflexibly honest and ever ready to show compassion, but, according to Tacitus, not so much to outsiders. Romans also considered Jewish monotheism to be a form of atheism because the Jews refused to worship the gods. Tacitus observed, "The Jews have purely mental conceptions of deity, as one in essence." From the Roman point of view, that kind of thing was bad for everyone because it was likely to provoke the divine displeasure of the gods. On top of all of that, according to Tacitus and other Roman writers, the Jews were misanthropists. Misanthropist is a word that means hater of human beings. The Romans labeled Jews as misanthropists because they kept to themselves, observed their own strange customs, lived within narrow sexual boundaries, refused to intermarry, strictly observed a peculiar diet, worshipped only one god, refused to venerate images and idols, and didn't sleep with non-Jews. Tacitus complained, "They sit apart at meals, they sleep apart, they abstain from intercourse with foreign women," all of which he took as clear signs of misanthropy. Moreover, circumcision was adopted by them as a mark of difference from other men. Those who come over to their religion adopt the practice and have this lesson first instilled into them, to despise all gods, to disown their country, and set at naught parents, children, and brethren. Tacitus garnered more evidence for Jewish hatred of humanity from the fact that they shunned images and statuary. "They call those profane who make representations of God in human shape out of perishable materials. They believe their God to be supreme and eternal, neither capable of representation nor of decay. They therefore do not allow any images to stand in their cities, much less in their temples. This flattery is not paid to their kings, nor this honor to our emperors." One more thing. In addition to all of the above indications of misanthropy, one of the Jewish peculiarities that most offended Tacitus was their shocking attitude toward abortion and infanticide. "It is a crime among them to kill any newly born infant." It shocked Tacitus because in the ancient world, parents decided whether to keep and raise a child only after it was born. If they decided they did not want a newborn, the father or mother simply brought the child outside and exposed it to the elements. By objecting to that common method of family planning, Jews showed themselves to be haters of human beings. Not of the world. Roman hatred for Judaism and the Jewish people explains why the Romans made it illegal for Gentiles to become disciples of Yeshua, the king of the Jews. They considered allegiance to Yeshua the same thing as becoming Jewish. Within just a few decades of Yeshua's crucifixion, the Romans were already crucifying Gentile Christians and sometimes burning them alive for following Jewish customs and beliefs. They referred to Christians as those who had slipped into Jewish ways and called the Yeshua followers misanthropists, atheists, and Jews. They arrested the disciples of Yeshua for committing crimes against the majesty of the emperor, namely for refusing to worship him as a god. They hated us because we were different. Disciples of Yeshua need to remember that we do not belong to this world. We don't seamlessly fit in with the broader culture around us, nor should we try to do so. We are a people set apart, not of the world, and not numbered with the nations. We live as aliens and strangers who abstain from the fleshly lusts the rest of the world pursue, 1 Peter 2:11. We keep our behavior excellent among the nations, even though they slander us as evildoers, 1 Peter 2:12. We do not conform to this world, but are transformed by the renewing of our minds so that we may show the will of God, that which is good and acceptable and perfect, Romans 12:2. The modern secular culture is apt to hate us no less than the Roman world did. The people of the world will be offended by our values, narrow sexual standards, customs, moral boundaries, and defense of human life, even that of the unborn. They will ridicule our beliefs and mock our convictions. That's nothing new. It's normal for the people of God to experience persecution and social ostracization. Yeshua said, "If the world hates you, you know that it has hated me before it hated you," John 15:18. The problem is not that the world hates us. It might indicate a problem if it didn't. The problem is that people don't react well to being hated. When we are hated, it's tempting to embrace the wisdom of this world and return hatred with hatred. That reaction discredits us and the name of our Master. Disciples of Yeshua love their enemies and pray for their persecutors. An equally wrong approach, suggested by the world's wisdom, is to try to impose our standards on everybody else. That might have made some sense when Western culture was, for the most part, a so-called Christian culture, if in name only. That's no longer the case. Trying to mandate our religious values on the broader culture may be tempting, but that won't work. Mixing church and state always turns out badly for both. Yeshua reminded us that the kingdom of heaven does not belong to this current world, and it can't be advanced by means and methods of this world. He said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." Wisdom of this world. "Come, let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply, and in the event of war, they will also join themselves to those who hate us, and fight against us, and depart from the land." Exodus 1:10. The nations of the world refer to the presence of the Jewish people in their midst as the Jewish problem. The Nazi Reich proposed and attempted a final solution to solve the Jewish problem. It didn't. They were not the last to try eliminating the Jews, and they certainly were not the first. The Egyptians claimed that distinction. The Egyptians said, "Come, let us deal wisely with them." The Bible distinguishes between two types of wisdom: worldly wisdom and godly wisdom. There's a big difference between the divine wisdom that comes from above and the world's wisdom. No matter how pious and right the cause may seem, a philosophy that results in bitter jealousy, that is baseless hatred, selfish ambition, and arrogance comes not from above. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder and every evil thing. James 3:15-16. The wisdom from above, on the other hand, is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. James 3:17-18. The wisdom from above leads to the knowledge of God, whereas the world, through its wisdom, did not come to know God. 1 Corinthians 1:21. By standards of worldly wisdom, the good news about the Messiah sounds like foolishness. The world laughs at believers. It turns out that the so-called foolishness of God is wiser than men. 1 Corinthians 1:25. The wisdom of the world cherishes power, strength, prestige, and money. It glorifies egotism, success, and domination over the lowly. You might think that disciples of Yeshua are immune to worldly wisdom, but we are just as susceptible to its persuasion as non-believers. It's difficult to resist. It can disguise itself as a patriotic crusader, defending truth, right, and religion. Its political rhetoric and fine arguments can snare even the sincere-hearted believer. For example, otherwise pious Christian teachers and churchmen have been the leading champions of anti-Semitism for generations. In Nazi Germany, churches touted Nazi propaganda, hung swastikas in their sanctuaries, saluted Hitler during Sunday services, and shrugged off concern over the genocide of the Jewish people. After the war, many protested, "We did not know." King Solomon answers them in these words, "Deliver those who are being taken away to death, and those who are staggering to slaughter. Oh, hold them back." If you say, "See, we did not know this," does he not consider it, who weighs the hearts? Does he not know it, who keeps your soul? And will he not render to man according to his work? Proverbs 24:11-12. Which type of wisdom are we heeding? James said, "Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom." James 3:13. A disciple of Yeshua should constantly check his or her attitudes, behaviors, and affiliations against the standards of God's wisdom as revealed in the Bible. Watch for signs of baseless hatred, xenophobia, selfishness, and arrogance. Remember that the Torah commands you to love both your neighbor and the stranger as yourself. The stranger who resides with you shall be to you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Leviticus 19:34. The war against children. So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor, and they built for Pharaoh storage cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. Exodus 1:11-12. King Solomon alluded to the multiplication of the children of Israel in Egypt and their suffering under Pharaoh. He said, "When the righteous increase, the people rejoice, but when a wicked man rules, people groan." Proverbs 29:2. The Egyptians hatched a plan to diminish the Hebrew population growth. They appointed slave drivers over the population to afflict the Hebrews with hard labor. They said, "Or else they will multiply." They did not necessarily need the labor force. They were trying to curb the exponential growth of Hebrew families. How does forced labor decrease population growth? Pharaoh hoped that the people's despair over their dark circumstances would diminish the incentive to bring children into the world. The Passover Haggadah we recite at the Passover Seder offers a further interpretation of the Hebrew word translated as affliction. The Hebrew word anah can also refer to ascetic practices such as fasting and sexual abstinence. An old Jewish tradition suggests that the Egyptians attempted to impose marital abstinence on the people of Israel. "The Lord heard our voice and saw our affliction," Deuteronomy 26:7. This refers to the enforcement of marital abstinence, Haggadah. The New Testament explains that the Egyptians encouraged the Hebrews to kill their newborns by afflicting them. Pharaoh supposed the Hebrews would prefer to let their babies die rather than to raise them as slaves. "It was he who took shrewd advantage of our race and mistreated our fathers so that they would expose their infants and they would not survive." Acts 7:19. The plan did not work. God countered Pharaoh's efforts by blessing the people with miraculous fertility. The more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied. When Pharaoh realized that his attempts to curb population growth had backfired, he employed midwives to kill the sons born to the Hebrew women. Spiritual beings. The Roman historian Tacitus thought it absurd that the Jews considered infanticide wrong. "It is a crime among them to kill any newly born infant," he exclaimed with incredulity. The rest of the first century world did not share that value with the Jews. Apostolic instruction to new Gentile disciples had to make the prohibitions on abortion and infanticide explicitly clear. The Didache, a first century digest of Yeshua's teachings for new disciples, says, "Do not murder children through abortion, nor kill them after they have been born." Didache 2:2. The wisdom of today's world agrees that killing a child after it has emerged from the birth canal is a crime. But the secular conscience does not extend that same standard to a child still in the womb. The secular world finds our objections to abortion just as baffling and aggravating as Tacitus did. Tacitus explained to his readers that Jews considered it a crime to kill a newly born infant because Jews possess the preposterous belief that the souls of all who perish are immortal. Hence their passion for propagating their race and contempt for death. In Jewish theology, the conception of a human being brings a spark of the divine into this present world. Every human child is a gift from God, possessing a living spirit, sent into this world on a mission from heaven. From the perspective of the secular materialist, a human life is cheaper than dirt, of less value than clay, because he failed to know the one who formed him, and inspired in him an active soul, and breathed into him a living spirit. But he considered our existence an idle game. Wisdom of Solomon 15:10-12. The midwives fear God. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. Exodus 1:17. Frustrated by the failure of his attempts to curb the explosive growth of the Hebrew population, Pharaoh ordered the midwives to kill all sons born to Hebrew women. The midwives chose the wisdom from above over the wisdom of the world. They feared God instead of Pharaoh. The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. The biblical idiom, to fear God, implies faith that he exists and that he punishes sin and rewards merit. It does not mean living in terror of God as one might live in fear of an abusive husband, a tyrannical father, or a ruthless despot. It means to believe he is real, that he is present, and that he sees all of our deeds. Actions reap consequences in the form of punishment or reward. The punishment might come in this world, the next, or even both. Likewise, the reward might come in this lifetime, in the kingdom, in the afterlife world of souls, or even after the soul has returned to the body in the resurrection from the dead for a share in the world to come. Biblical wisdom keeps God's justice in view. Solomon asked, "Does he not consider it who weighs the hearts? And does he not know it who keeps your soul? And will he not render to man according to his work?" Proverbs 24:12. The midwives chose to fear the one who weighs hearts, keeps souls, and renders to each person according to his work. They risked their own lives in this world by defying Pharaoh's orders for the sake of saving the lives of children. They did as the master told his disciples, "Do not fear those who kill the body, but are unable to kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell, in Gehenna." Matthew 10:28. The midwives acted in faith, placing their fear in the unseen God, in full possession of the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Hebrews 11:1. Thanks to the bravery of the Hebrew midwives, the people multiplied and became very mighty. Exodus 1:20. The Torah records the names of the two midwives, Shifra and Puah. Pharaoh asked them to explain why they had not carried out his orders. They replied shrewdly, "It's because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are like the wild beasts and give birth before the midwife arrives." Exodus 1:19. That is, the people are like the beasts of the field that do not require the help of midwives. Midrash Rabbah. The fear of the Lord did not disappoint the midwives. They received reward in this world for their deeds. God was good to the midwives. Because the midwives feared God, he established households for them. Exodus 1:20 and 21. Pharaoh issued a new order requiring all parents to cast every newborn son into the Nile River. The decree applied not only to the children of the Hebrews, he imposed the same decree upon his own people. The Path of the Spirit. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. Exodus 2:2. King Solomon said, "Just as you do not know the path of the wind, and how bones are formed in the womb of the pregnant woman, so you do not know the activity of God who makes all things." Ecclesiastes 11:5. Biblical Hebrew uses the same word, ruach, for wind and spirit. In this case, the word is better translated as spirit because Solomon was talking about how human conception occurs. The conception and birth of a human child involves a conjunction of a divine spirit from heaven and a mortal physical body. Just as you do not know the path of the spirit as it enters the body and how bones are formed in the womb of a pregnant woman. In the apocryphal wisdom of Solomon, the king describes his own physical conception, gestation, and birth in poetic terms. Read it aloud, thoughtfully, realizing that the same story applies to you and all of your ancestors, stretching back to Adam, "I also am mortal, like all men, a descendant of the first formed child of earth, and in the womb of a mother, I was molded into flesh. Within the period of 10 months, compacted with blood, from the seed of a man and the pleasure of marriage. And when I was born, I began to breathe the common air and fell upon the kindred earth, and my first sound was a cry, like that of all. I was nursed with care in swaddling cloths, for no king has had a different beginning of existence. There is for all mankind one entrance into life and a common departure." Wisdom of Solomon 7:1-6. Let's think about the path of the Spirit and the spiritual meaning of human conception and birth. It's about souls coming into the world. It's an important idea in Jewish teaching. The story of the sojourn of the children of Israel in Egypt can be used to illustrate the soul's descent into this narrow world of concealment. The inner man takes up residence in the body like a man living in a tent or putting on clothing. 2 Corinthians 4:16, 5:1-4. Here in this narrow world, the inner man experiences travails and afflictions. However, we aren't intended to stay here forever. We are supposed to be preparing for our ultimate redemption and exodus from this world and our return to paradise. No one knows the path of the Spirit. We won't know until we finish our own spiritual path. But Scripture offers hints and clues, and from those, Judaism infers some profound insights and speculations. Jewish theology teaches that during the 6 days of creation, God created the spiritual souls of every human being that will ever live. According to one idea, all souls were part of the primordial Adam, the image of God. The Talmud says, "This was done due to the importance of maintaining peace among my people, so that one person cannot claim superiority over another by saying, 'My ancestry is greater than your ancestry.'" Our common origin refutes racism, ethnocentric bigotries, and national prejudices. All the souls began with Adam and are, in a sense, descendants of Adam, just as all flesh began with Adam. It's not necessary to take it literally, but the Talmud also holds that these Adamic souls remain in the presence of God until their turn to be born into the world. They wait in a part of the heavenly paradise called the guf, a word that means the body. The pre-incarnate spirits are metaphorically pictured as something like winged doves, so the guf is sometimes referred to as a type of spiritual columbarium. Again, spiritual concepts like this should not be taken literally. One opinion in the Talmud says that the Messiah will not come until the guf is emptied of all its souls. The concept of souls in the guf waiting to be born elevates the unique significance of every human life. It makes each person's conception and birth into the world a meaningful and important event. Each person has a unique mission that only he or she can accomplish. Every newborn baby brings the Messiah closer, simply by being born. According to Wisdom of Solomon, God first forms a human being in its mother's womb, then inspires in it an active soul, that is the nephesh, and finally breathes into it a living spirit, the neshama. The living spirit must transition from the broad, expansive world of souls into the narrow places of human physicality. The spirit self, accustomed to a world without limitation, finds itself uncomfortably cramped inside the narrow confines of a tiny human body. Wisdom of Solomon says that the perishable body weighs down the soul, and this earthy tent burdens the mind. So our perceptions are limited. Within the confines of the body, we no longer remember or see the spiritual world from which we came. We can hardly guess at what is on earth. And what is at hand, we find with labor, Wisdom of Solomon 9, 15 and 16. We labor in the wearisome world, like the children of Israel, laboring in Egypt. Birth of a Redeemer. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying. And she had pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Exodus 2:6. Every generation seems to produce new villains who try to solve the Jewish problem by eliminating the Jews. The Passover Haggadah observes, "In every generation they rise up against us to destroy us, but the Holy One, blessed be He, rescues us from their hand." The stories in the Bible show that in every generation, God raises up redeemers to rescue His people. Jewish sources speak of Moses as the first redeemer and the Messiah as the last redeemer. In this equation, the first redeemer established the program to be followed and ultimately completed by the last redeemer. Wisdom of Solomon speaks of how God raises specific individuals and inspires them with wisdom through His indwelling Holy Spirit. In every generation, she passes into holy souls and makes them friends of God and prophets, for God loves nothing so much as the man who lives with wisdom. Wisdom of Solomon 7, 27 and 28. The divine wisdom empowered Moses to stand up against Pharaoh. She entered the soul of a servant of the Lord and withstood fearsome kings with wonders and signs. Wisdom of Solomon 10:16. The brave midwives preserved the Redeemer's life because they chose the fear of the Lord above the fear of man. Neither would the Redeemer have survived if not for the bravery of the child's mother, who, when she could no longer conceal her son, nevertheless refused to drown her baby in the Nile. She chose life and floated him among the reeds in a basket. If not for the compassion of Pharaoh's daughter, who transcended bigotry to pity the squalling child of one of the hated Hebrews, Israel's Redeemer would have been lost. Each of those women supposed their compassion saved only a single infant child. They did not know their small acts of compassion saved an entire nation. For though the Egyptians had mockingly rejected him, who long before had been cast out and exposed, at the end of the events, they marveled at him. Wisdom of Solomon 11:14. God raised up a Redeemer to lead the children of Israel out of the narrow place of their bondage and into the broad expanse of freedom. Likewise, the souls of men and women who labor in this narrow world of concealment and troubles need a Redeemer to lead us safely to the place of life where the light shines with no diminution. The Redeemer came from heaven, born the Son of God. Yet, He also came to us like all men, a descendant of the first-form child of earth, and in the womb of a mother molded into flesh within a period of 10 months. When He was born, He began to breathe the common air and fell upon the kindred earth, and His first sound was a cry, like that of all. He was nursed with care, in swaddling cloths, for no king has had a different beginning of existence. Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.